Today on Straight Talk Africa, some of the key events that are expected to shape the continent in 2019. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Salih, and today we are taking a look at the political realities that are dominating the news and are likely to reshape Africa in 2019. Over the past 12 months across Africa, a number of crucial elections have taken place that will set the political stage for 2019. VOA's Zoe Laudaki has more.
2018 was an election year unlike any other in Africa. Voters in Zimbabwe went to the polls for the first time in nearly 30 years without longtime leader Robert Mugabe as a candidate after he was forced to resign. The winner was Emmerson Mnangagwa, a fellow member of the ZANU-PF party. But many Zimbabweans say little has changed since Mugabe left.
They've been failing since 1980. So we can't expect them to do anything now.
Ethiopians entered a new political era with the nomination of new Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Ahmed introduced sweeping reforms, freed political prisoners, pledged to open key sectors of the economy to foreign investment, and ended decades of war and mistrust with its former foe, Eritrea. Ahmed has been hailed around the world and at home for his achievements.
Our country is thirsty for a good person and a good leader. Our country is thirsty for someone who can bring unity and stability.
The historic reconciliation between Ethiopia and Eritrea led to the reopening of the border for the first time in 20 years.
Now everyone can see what the benefit of peace is, the benefit and the effects of war and conflict that took away lives, destroyed properties, and caused pain to many.
In West Africa, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari's announcement that he would run for re-election was met with mixed reactions. He faces a tight election battle in February 2019, and his critics say that his long-standing anti-corruption agenda has failed to yield any major convictions. They also say that he's failed to handle the economy properly, which has resulted in the country falling into recession.
What we expected is not what we have seen. Somehow we are disappointed in one way or the other.
In Madagascar, André Rajoelina has been declared the winner of a runoff presidential election, according to full provisional results released last Thursday by the Electoral Commission. With 80% of Madagascar's 25 million people surviving on less than $2 a day, many had high hopes that these elections would bring about a leader who will lift them out of poverty.
With every new president, life has become more and more difficult.
In September, South Sudan's former vice president turned opposition leader Riek Machar signed a peace treaty with the country's president Salva Kiir, signaling the end of a brutal, ethnically charged 5-year civil war. The East African nation gained independence in 2011. Meanwhile, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, amid fears of electoral fraud, citizens nervously await the results from Sunday's chaotic presidential election. Internet and SMS services remain down for a third day on Wednesday after the government imposed a total block on internet connections. Both the opposition and the ruling coalition are claiming victory, and the nation's long-suffering youth is yearning for change.
We are totally rich. That is what they tell us. Now, I've never seen that wealth anywhere. All I see is sand and sun in my country. I've never seen that wealth.
Africa's citizens are now waiting to see how the outcome of multiple historic elections will shape the socioeconomic landscape across the continent in 2019. Zoe Liudaki, VOA News.
Thanks, Zoe, for that report. Joining us here in our studio our three distinguished guests, Wafa May Elamine, a Sudanese diaspora advocate, activist, and vice president of Moving Forward Sudan, Mira Woods of Africans Rising for Justice, Peace, and Dignity. And last but not least is Dr. at least according to the German protocol, Abdul Karim Bangula, professor of political science at American University's Center for Global Peace. Well, I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa, and in particular, you for the first time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be sitting on the panel with these lovely people and to just talk about our country and our continent.
You're most welcome. And of course, you probably had me when I alluded to the fact that you're looking at two individuals that have, in one way or the other, really contributed so much to such an extent that I am very proud of regarding them as some of those who have helped to build and shape this program, Straight Talk Africa. Thank you for contribution.
We are so honored. We can't believe it's 18 years now. And so we credit your vision and hard work for building what we see as quite a powerful institution. So thank you for helping us start the year with Straight Talk Africa.
You're most welcome. I think that this program can probably demonstrate and in fact to go out to prove, especially those critics who think that Africa cannot work. It can work.
Leadership and hard work.
Leadership and hard work. And of course, it takes more than one. It takes two and perhaps more to raise a child, as they say. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the mother, father, that is called Africa. What is your report card so far? You obviously look like you belong to a very recent generation.
Yeah, so as you can see, I'm a millennial. Mm-hmm. I'm a Sudanese American, and I'm proud of both identities. And, you know, I feel like even though I'm far from Africa, and I'm sure we can all relate, feels like Africa never left me and my family. So carry it with me everywhere, carry Sudan everywhere I go. And I think a lot of people within my age range and younger are experiencing the same kind of sense of urgency to love our culture more.
It's very interesting that you seem to be linked to Africa and to Sudan, especially when I listened to your poem. Mm-hmm. Very interesting poem. You pretty much talking about the power of the Nile.
Yeah.
Summary.
Yeah.
Precisely, what's that and what does it mean in the context of the mother continent?
So the Pearl of the Nile is Sudan. It is the most beautiful and most glorious that, and I mean, the song itself just was remade by a modern Sudanese artist who just goes to show how we can transpose our culture and our history in different ways that are kind of attached to our mediums. Like I write, mm-hmm, and some mm-hmm. people express that through music, and just hearing that song and knowing the meaning behind it, it's so important, especially during a time when we're having a difficult time seeing the beauty of our country and we hear so much about it. And as a member of the diaspora, being so far removed from it, you have to create these connections on your own. You have to build them and foster them and grow them. That's talking to our parents, talking to our uncles, connecting with Sudanese people all over the world. That's the power of the Nile, you know, it's the root of it all.
Very interesting, Wafa. The last time I checked, Sudan's claim to the Nile is pretty much that both the White Nile, which originates from Uganda, and the Blue Nile, which originates from Ethiopia, converge
right there
in the Sudan mm-hmm. before heading on to Egypt and the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So why would this claim really be justified and not Uganda, not Ethiopia?
Well, I mean, I say it from a position of pride to be Sudanese and just to know what glory and talent comes from there. And in the last year, I've connected to so many different young professionals around the world who are learning about our history and taking that history and creating documentation of it, you know? And the fact that Sudan is the meeting point of such a powerful symbolic river in the continent just goes to show that Sudanese people can connect with so many people in Africa, around the world, and we're doing it, and we're doing it powerfully. So it's just an extension of our Nile.
Very interesting. How do you feel about the contributions of those generations, including mine, who came before you?
I think they've paved a way for us in my generation to be able to take ownership, reclaim that narrative in a way that's at a shifting point in the world. I think we're at a very pivotal point in the world where a lot of change can happen in such a short time, and it's going to be mobilized by people like me who grew up and who studied, who are now in a position to be able to take that knowledge and those resources and put it towards good. And we learned so much about the foundations of the continent, of the country, from our parents and, like you said, your generations above, before us, and we're hoping just to continue that legacy to the generations after us.
So would it be fair to say that you feel very confident and comfortable that the generations before you have been able to provide you the shoulders on which your generation has actually been able to stand in order to see a little bit further?
Yeah. So, I mean, in Sudan in particular, this isn't the first revolution that's happened, and it's happened peacefully and successfully. So we're learning from our parents, but we're kind of transforming it in a way that's current to our times. And I think very, very confidently there are some lessons to learn from and mistakes that may have been made, but that's where we come in, and that's where we kind of bridge those gaps and find that common ground to be able to move forward in a way that's ready for the future and ready for the generations to come.
Very interesting. What about you, Emira, of the Africans, you know, rising? There are some people who have actually been saying that, look, we just can't continue having more of the same. Africa needs a paradigm shift.
Well,
how do you respond to that?
I feel like my colleague has so beautifully said it, the way poets often do, right, throughout time. You know, it is young people with, it's almost, you know, it's that the Sankofa moment, right, where it's a visionary, mythical bird.
You're talking
flying
about
forward,
Sankofa,
right?
This a film is made by Haile Gerima?
I'm talking about an Akan mythical, legendary image.
Which is reflected,
right?
Of
which
course,
is reflected
in a great
film.
Movie by...
Exactly, by Haile Gerima. But it's essentially, you know, looking back, that bird, that mythical bird, while flying forward. And I think we are at that moment where, led by incredibly bold and courageous young people throughout the continent and the diaspora, we are doing just that. We're learning from history, from the Patrice Lumumbas, you know, who were our, you know, revolutionary leaders, visionary leaders, Thomas Sankara. We're learning from them, but also our young leaders are forging new paths. So, you know, when I think of the Nile, I think of the Friends of Lake Turkana, just on the other side of the border from Ethiopia and Kenya, where it is a young woman who is from that region, as you say, was in the diaspora, and then has gone back to lead a movement fighting for the community to have its rights to fish in waters that have been dammed further upstream in Ethiopia. And also fighting for a planet, recognizing that with climate change, Africa is at the epicenter, and that we must do all we can, not in the future, but now. So it is those young leaders that are using tools of technology, social media, all these ways to communicate so effectively, and they're forging new paths, right? It is leaders on all issues, human rights, social justice, women's rights, across the continent, that are saying no to what is the status quo, demanding greater accountability from all of our leaders, and actually seizing the mantle of leadership across the board, whether it's those fighting for a free Togo or for a more democratic Cameroon. I mean, across the board, you have these young, dynamic, often women leaders. And I think it's also reflected here as we begin a new Congress in the United States with a dynamic young Somali woman coming out of a refugee legacy, but entering Congress today. So it is the continent, it is the diaspora, and it is this new leadership that has learned the lessons from the visionary leaders of the past, that has critiqued the unaccountable misleaders of the past, some of whom are there presently, right? But are the leaders that are going to carry us into this 21st century in such a bold and courageous and powerful ways. And so that's what I think gives me hope when we start off with poetry. So thank you for that.
Very interesting, and of course, really very interesting words, especially to begin with the new year, 2019. Hail, doctor, or is it hail, mister, or at least according to German protocol, a person or an individual that has more than one PhD, who is normally called a doctor. For the Germans, they say, doctor, doctor, if you have two. Now, the fact of the matter is we're talking about a guy here who has not one, not two, not three, not four, but in fact, five PhDs. And we're talking about and PhDs, not honorary doctorates of, you know, of science or arts or whatever, but actually and PhDs. How do you do it?
Well, it depends who you talk to. If you talk to my student, they say it's crazy, or others will say he has no life. Maybe not having a life may be the right answer.
At UCLA, we used to call it, when I was a graduate student doing the only PhD I can claim, we used to call it a pretty hard date. And there are others who called it...
My sisters have hit on very important points about the transition from the elders to the younger ones to continue. Unfortunately, the older ones don't want to give up the torch, the mantle. This is a problem.
They don't.
I see al-Bashir, for example, in Sudan. Of course, you know, I was on the show here. We had to fight against the ICC because you cannot be criminalizing our own leaders and leave those in the West and other places that are doing even worse things, just focusing on Africa. But it comes to a point where a leader has to give up something. In West Africa, I have something we call the wahala. That's trouble. I call it the Sudan wahala. If you look at Sudan's more current history, every trouble or every steering always have begun in December. It was December 15, 2013, that all hell broke loose when the current five-year civil war in South Sudan take place, and it continues, and with no end in sight. And now it's December 19, young folks are now protesting in northern Sudan for change. At what point does my good friend al-Bashir, who I like personally, because when you deal with somebody at a particular level, there is some amity that is very special.
You know him well enough?
Not well enough, but let's just say we've worked around this ambit to get to know who the person is, because there are certain struggle as a people against the outsider who is trying to infringe upon your people. That's one struggle. But internal struggles have to be taken care of in a family way. And I would hope that he can decide to give it up to the new generation to run with this, to take the torch.
But what about...
I'm afraid, though, that if he doesn't, there's only one alternative of removing him, and that is through a military coup. And this is something most of us don't want to even think about.
You know,
but it seems like that's usually the only way, the only time some of our elder statesmen listen. Yes, sir.
Some of these African leaders others might call them rulers, who happen to be democratically challenged, mm-hmm. when you ask them why they are in power that long, they simply tell you they are succumbing to the pressure of their people. Who are those people when they actually talk about power belongs to the people?
Well, that's the question we'll be asking. When we talk about the democratic project, it has done very well in Africa. That is, if you measure a democratic project in terms of elections, who wins, who comes in, you would give it an A+.
Election as an event?
Event, yes. But we know,
but
I've done several studies.
How much really, I mean, when you talk about elections, how much are, in fact, those elections? Mm-hmm. Do they, in fact, meet the democratic threshold of an election, or do they, in fact, meet what some have characterized as selections?
Well, as a matter of fact, the studies I've done have shown no correlation whatsoever, statistical correlation, between democracy and good governance. And this is where we have to start putting the emphasis on. There is no correlation between democracy and peace. We still have elections taking place, but we still have a lot of chaos, wars, and all sorts of push and whatever you want to call them these days, taking place all over the continent. Some are more pronounced in the West, some we don't even talk about. We have a third world war in the Lake region. We don't call it a third world war because whenever you have all these other different countries from so many different parts engaging in the war, it's a world war. But we don't call it that because, you know, as long as it's not West, East participating, then we don't call it that. But disappointingly, is also our intellectuals. Our intellectuals are not coming up with solutions, suggestions on how to fix many of these problems. What has happened now?
So what actually makes them intellectuals?
Well, that is now the $2 million question. We are not very good with the new technology, the internet, to even claim having certain degrees. It doesn't matter if you want to claim what you don't have, and claiming to invent things. And now with the YouTube, you got those of us who are very good at using attention-catching phrases. So that way we are popular, people want to listen to us, people want to hear you. By the end of the day, what we suggest is vacuous because it's not based on any deep intellectual or deep thinking, whereas we can come up with what our ancient people used to call the rhetoric, or what did they call in Kiswahili, putting the heat on the stove and then let it cool off and all of those things. We don't do it anymore. Now we are more happy to say things that make people feel good. And so that way we are invited, we are paraded, and those who come with the tough questions or come up with much more rhetoric, as the ancient Egyptian would call them, solutions, we are shoved aside because it is too difficult for some of our policymakers to take and run with.
Sounds like what you characterize as solutions, someone else might probably characterize them as illusions, facades, make-believe.
Make-believe, yeah.
Taking people through the motions.
Yes.
Now, let me come to Wafa. You are Sudanese and indeed a very, very proud Sudanese and perhaps righteous. So, only yesterday, you celebrated 72 years of political independence from the condominium of the British and the Egyptians.
Yeah, and I think there's a direct correlation to the uprisings happening in the December time.
December's.
It's because it's right around our Day of Independence where we feel the most sense of pride in being Sudanese, and we all come together towards the end of the year already reflectively and introspectively, just thinking about ourselves personally and our growth. And then when you incorporate that with the day that your country received its independence, your people are automatically very prideful. And I think yesterday was a bittersweet day for us, at least for me, because I was celebrating a really great year and overcoming a lot of things personally. And then at the same time, I was seeing these protests for the last 2 weeks and hearing about my family getting hurt and all of that. And it becomes a lot closer to home. You know, it becomes so much closer, and I'm thousands of miles away. But I think I feel the pain just maybe the same, if not worse, than my parents feel it, because it's this glorious place we hear about that I haven't had the luxury to see yet, and I want to make sure that I get to. And I think a lot of people share those sentiments.
You know, it reminds me of a study done in the current Democratic Republic of the Congo. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was known as Zaire, of Mobutu Sese Seko Wazabanga. Back in the 1980s, I was a graduate school at UCLA. A team of researchers went there and talked to many people downtown Kinshasa, the capital, about independence. Mm. And the ordinary Congolese were actually wondering when this thing called independence is going to come to an end, because it didn't seem, frankly, to deliver even some of the crumbs that they used to get under the colonialists, you know, that kind of stuff. What is happening in Katumu, for example, and in more than 20 other urban centers, mm-hmm. in the Sudan, essentially protesting about prices, for example, of bread, really, fuel and all that kind of stuff. Is it an expression almost that is similar to that? When is this thing called independence going to come to an end?
I think it's the idea of what comes with independence. You know, when you get independence, you expect the basic liberties of freedom and to live. And the protests did start on bread, but I think bread is symbolic for something a little bit more. The word bread in Arabic in Sudanese Arabic is actually aish. Mm-hmm. And the core of that is life.
Uh-huh.
To aish, like yes, to live. Life. So the protests being about bread and ish, mm-hmm. is really a lot deeper than that. Mm-hmm. And I think we have an interesting way of trying to translate our narrative to people in the Western world in such a short time that by the time we're done having the conversation, we didn't even hit the core of it, which is life and humans and just living and all of that, education, children, everything, just the core of the basics that we're taught as we're growing up. So I think the idea of independence really has to be scrutinized from that kind of perspective of what do you get along with that? Because if you're going to fight for it, you have to get something in return. And I think people are just asking for the bread. You know,
and what about that, Emira? Because let's face it, when you look at Africans, you think about people who are citizens or who should be citizens, but actually behave or are treated as subjects.
Well, I think the issue is dignity. It goes back to that, right? People are thirsting for dignity, that core essence of life, human dignity. And I think what you see is it's a natural thirst for, you know, life better than your grandparents. And yet, in many of the contexts, you know, whether it's oil-producing countries like Sudan or South Sudan, or it's incredibly wealthy countries like the DRC with, you know, coltan and all of these vital resources for the global economy, people feel a sense of being kind of stripped of their dignity, of their right to kind of make decisions for their lives, for the lives of their children, to put food on the table. I mean, so I think it's a basic human need, that dignity. And so I think what you have is this powerful expression of people saying, we're not going to take it anymore. We're the majority. Right? Why should a narrow elite allied with external forces, perhaps, right, be making decisions for our lives and for future generations at our peril? And so I think, you know, whether it's Tunisia, where we saw yet again, you know, a Malaysian, somebody taking their life in such a dramatic fashion, you know, it's a thirst for a better way. And it's a cry to say we've had enough. We're going to stand up for our rights, and we're going to push back against what we see is a grave injustice. Until, you know, both political independence and economic independence are secured.
Unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally, despite your great thought. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, so please don't go away because we'll be right back with you.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
Able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
A reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook. And you can also watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, anger over rising prices, shortages of bread and fuel, and a cash crisis has incited demonstrations across Sudan and against President Omar al-Bashir. Crowds flooding the streets of Khartoum have been chanting, "The people want the fall of the regime." Is Sudan in the precipice of change? An in-depth discussion on the politics of Sudan on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Today we are discussing the events in Africa that are most likely to shape the continent in 2019. Our guests are Wafa May Elamin, a Sudanese diaspora advocate, activist, and vice president of Moving Forward Sudan, Emira Woods of Africans Rising for Justice, Peace, and Dignity, and last but not least, Abdul Karim Bangura, Professor of Political Science at American University Center for Global Peace. And of course, as I told you earlier, he is doctor five times, at least according to German protocol. Well, I have to say frankly again that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
You're most welcome. Now, doctor, as you heard from both your fellow panelists earlier, they seem to say that the people of Africa feel, they have these feelings, frankly, that they are shortchanged. And if true, then how come they do not effectively assert themselves? If indeed the power belongs to them, as their leaders or rulers actually sometimes or often say, do these people in fact believe that they are the power indeed, that they are citizens of their communities, that they owe allegiance, for example, to the state, and therefore they are the primary stakeholders in those countries, because not only do they in fact have constitutional rights, but actually they do have inalienable rights, birthrights, if you will. But how come they actually behave as subjects who owe allegiance to an individual authority who might be a king, a presidential monarch, an emperor, or a kabaka?
That's a loaded question.
With no rights, basically, because they can only hope for
tough question.
Privileges handed to them by these individual authorities, really.
Well, whether or not the people really are the power is relative. From an idealist perspective, they are supposed to be the power. They are supposed to be the decider of who rules them. But from a realist
they participate in the processes like elections.
In the process, in the elections.
And results are supposed to be reflections of the will of the people. Their participation.
But the real politic is a different reality altogether. My sister Almira from Liberia, we have a common friend, Dr. George Kia, who went and ran for the presidency 2 elections ago. By the time he would leave Monrovia to go to the next town to campaign, Ellen Sirleaf has already been to 3 towns. By the time he gets there, they say, what are you showing up here for? We've already eaten the rice and the meat because of the differences in the mode of transportation. She has the helicopter to fly around. He has to drive through those rugged roads to go from town to town. As long as the people who are in power have the what we call the instrument of compulsion, the military, the police, and all the other...
The institutions of violence.
Power, yes. Then they are going to dominate. You see?
I think we have a lot of examples that has happened in many countries. We also have examples like the Gambia, again, led by young, dynamic, bold, courageous leaders and women, where people said no, right? It was Gambia has decided. The people have decided, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At the end of the day, you had a president who, because of the neighboring countries as well, enforcing the will of the people, who had to step down.
You have to give credit to ECOWAS.
To ECOWAS, a regional body that said, we will not stand for democratic processes being undermined. Right? And we have to all understand, it's not only elections that are the testament of democracy. Mm. It's also a free and open press. It's also a free and open internet so that there can be the communications and those platforms. And that's not the case in many countries.
Cameroon, Togo, because as we talk right now, the internet is in fact shut in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Exactly.
I'm happy you threw in the ECOWAS thing. And since I call myself a Senegalese Gambian anyway, because I do spend a whole lot of time working with Codestria.
I thought you were African.
That's what my wonderful folks in Senegal say. So I will give them credit because they are watching now too. But if it wasn't for Sall, President Sall, I think...
The president of Senegal.
Yes.
Macky Sall.
Our Jammeh in Gambia would have still been there. They don't like each other, and Sall was determined that he was going to listen to what the people have dictated. But Sall, and she's right.
But also,
in that
let's face
because
being president of Senegal also comes with moral authority.
Yes, yes.
Because there is, in fact, a tradition of democracy.
Yes.
In Senegal.
In Senegal, that is correct.
Well, it's a tradition that was supported, reinforced, again, by young people, by hip-hop artists, by musicians and poets, right? Mm-hmm. They said no when Abdoulaye Wade wanted to hang on for a third term. They organized. There were demonstrations throughout Senegal. And I happened to be there, on the five-year anniversary where they took to the streets again and said, we put you in office, Macky Sall. You must respond to our demands, right? So it is, young people at the leadership of these social movements that are linking up with trade unions, that are linking up with environmental justice activists, that are using technology in new and interesting ways. And I do believe that the Codestrias, the academics, those who are activist-oriented, those who are rooted in movement and movement building, are also on the right side of history because they are part of this progression that is demanding rights, demanding dignity, demanding justice.
Yeah, the first part of your question, Mwale Musali, is the shortchanging. Why do the people feel shortchanged? And they have a very good reason to feel shortchanged. In that if you go to the Codestria site, there is a study I did on tipping points and sustainability, where I look at the entire continent over a very long period of longitudinal study. We Africans are very good at coming up with projects and programs and policies. 2-3 years later, they are dead, they are gone. Why? Because we do not build in how you sustain these programs, how you sustain these policies. And so when the people now are expecting that you deliver, you say free education, good. Free education to what? When the system itself has some structural problems that are not going to make the education any effective. So now the people are looking at, where are our kids going to be so smart, be so productive, be so educated in this free education that they can come back and really contribute to the society? Mm. That is not done because in our plans, in our programs, we fail to build in sustainability aspects. And we have to be very careful also that many of our countries in Africa are on the tipping point. They're on the edge. South Africa is a good case in point. The thing that saved South Africa is because they removed Zuma and put in Cyril Ramaphosa, who is a very close friend. And we had that conversation. He and I went to dinner when I was in Joburg, and we had that conversation of what needs to be done in South Africa, because he was very timid in even taking over the leadership. When the people wanted him, I said, Brother Cyril, you have to step in because the people see in you a vision that they think South Africa needs that can really save this country. The way Zuma was going was not the right way the people wanted. He was a little bit hesitant because he wanted to respect the traditional way of respecting the elders and following protocol, and he did. Things worked out right. That is postponing the tipping point of South Africa right now. A lot of protests, a lot of schisms, a lot of South Africans hating other Africans who died for their independence, what now they call xenophobia, or whatever term people want to use. So we have to also start paying very close attention to those societies, those governments that are the tipping point. Cameroon is a case in point.
But Professor, let's stay a little bit in South Africa. What about the fact that South Africa has demonstrated that it actually does have strong institutions that happen to be independent, and that the ruling ANC itself, in fact, is sufficiently democratic?
That is correct.
Because not only has it recalled Jacob Zuma, but you also know that it actually recalled earlier Thabo Mbeki. Mm-hmm. And still survives.
Okay, let's give all credit. ANC is the oldest political party on the African continent, been around for over 100 years. But the ANC is in trouble, let's be frank, right? There are pressures to the left of the ANC because the ANC has, as far as many, those same, you know, young people started out a demonstration for fees must fall, school fees. Were the issue, right? It was a tangible thing. Fees must fall, transferred into Zuma must go. Economic, political, combined. Young people, also trade unions, say the ANC is not meeting our needs. And they are putting pressure on the ANC. So we have to look to South Africa going into these elections. I think there will be continued pressure on the ANC from the left. They will have to pay attention to kind of their own legacy of things like the Freedom Charter that said we're going to put the resources of the country to the best interests of the people of the country. I mean, so some of those ideologies actually speak against a path of neoliberalism that, that many would want to follow, whether, you know, again, the World Bank, IMF saying you can't have free education, you can't have low school fees, in spite of the pressure for the people for those services. So I think the pressures will continue, and I think it will force the ANC to remember its own roots, and I think there may well be some very strong political pressures from the left, just as you see, quite frankly, here in the U.S., right? These political pressures from the left of people saying, we want free education. We want affordable health care. We need those essential services because they will ensure the well-being of our people and of future generations. And we want to protect the planet for the long term. So these demands are being heard all over the continent and in the diaspora. And so I think we've got to move beyond the bubble of the leaders, the elites, and recognize that the real power is it's rooted in communities of struggle that are demanding a different way.
So if I heard you correctly, you are basically talking about the compelling need for social, economic, political justice.
And environmental, right? Because many of these leaders are thinking about the present with the climate catastrophe that we're in, and that Africa is at the epicenter, and ways through that that will bring both decent jobs, right? Technology that's going to bring clean jobs, and also protect the planet for the future.
That brings me to the issue of the need for civic education. For people to have an opportunity to know what they are and what their power and what the possibilities are, if in fact they can mobilize, organize, and not agonize. Because in South Africa in particular, the country is still lacking again the issue of strong institutions. Mm-hmm. Independent judiciary, for example. You have an independent, or at least something akin to an independent media, which helps to bring about checks and balances and all that kind of stuff. But what about across the continent? How do we bring about civic education, sincerely?
I think there will be many ways, and you see now social movements are doing it. There are, again, it's through music, it's through ways that you reach people's hearts, yes. Right? But the Democratic Republic of the Congo, it is young people that are sharing information. Again, it's difficult now with the closures of the internet, right? But they are a force that's educating at the community level throughout that vast country.
You're having an election where a significant part of the country actually has been disfranchised.
Yeah.
The eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is, some say, is in fact the stronghold of the opposition political parties. You still have what they call an election. And you're supposed to get results next week on Sunday.
Without a doubt, it seemed as a scam election. Let's be frank, right? All the issues of the voter machines and all of these problems, the scale is tipped in the hand of the ruling party. That is clear, right? I think the issue that we're discussing here is the forces to counter that. Those forces are very much alive throughout the
DR Congo. And that's not limited
Congo.
To DRC. It is pretty much really the vast majority of African countries are like that. We have, of course, a few exceptions. We should talk about, for example, Madagascar, the island republic of Madagascar. They did it. They just did it. How did they do it? Can other African countries learn from that type of template?
Well, I think we have Botswana about to go to elections also in 2019.
Right.
I mean, they have a history of transfer of leadership. I mean, you know, of creating institutions. I think there are examples there. They need to be replicated in other areas. Where
they do, except that the ruling party is the same party that regained its political independence from the British in the mid-60s.
I think another key thing to add in with the importance of civic education, we also have to equally educate the grassroots initiatives about their opportunities in civic involvement. Mm-hmm. And I think we experience that so much, especially in Africa and within our countries. Tribalism separates us so much from the access of resources that as we're educating people who may not know that their voice can be heard and there is a democratic approach to things, we have to equally accompany that with the lessons that they can learn to fine-tune and cater through their civic institutions to be able to advocate for their rights, to be able to advocate for the changes they want to see. And I think that's where this idea of sustainability that you were speaking of, Doctor, earlier comes in, of incorporating those kinds of conversations as we make political decisions and talking about the whys and what's successful and what isn't. So I think finding that common ground is super important, and I think 2019 is going to be that year for
Wafa. There are some people who say that your generation really has a great opportunity that probably has not been seen in centuries, really.
Yeah.
Because you're looking at a guy like me, I am a beneficiary of what I call the Gutenberg factor, the printing press. But you guys, you are social media.
Yeah.
You are young, you are educated, you are more exposed, and guess what? You are the majority on the continent. Mm-hmm. How do you turn Africa around?
I think it goes down to passing the torch, and not only passing it, but kind of sharing the responsibility of making that change. Because I think my generation, I can see very clearly, like, I have younger cousins who are on phones and they're 3 years old. And, you know, and the world is exposed to so many things that aren't appropriate for three-year-olds to be seeing. So I think the importance of using those social media tools to kind of bring about that positive change, but also give room for that balance to do fun things on it too. I think that's going to play such a big role in turning Africa around, is letting the voices be heard in different mediums and different platforms, and letting those voices contribute to the change that will impact them. And I think that's pivotal of what's happening right now. And you can see that with the panel, like, we're all so different from each other, but we're learning about the ways that we can work together and work for our continent as a whole.
Because we are listening to each other, among other things.
Yeah.
But what about situations you are talking about passing on the torch? What about those situations, those countries, for example, where the people at the helm do not see the need for passing on the torch or the baton, so to speak, because apparently they think that they are perhaps politically God's gifts to their communities, that they are uniquely gifted, really, that without them, their societies are not there. We can begin with the longest serving ruler in the world. We are talking about Teodoro Obiang Basangu of Equatorial Guinea. Mm-hmm. Came to power 1979, still going. An incredibly rich country, but very, very poor people. But the family of the man, incredibly rich, owns a lot of, you know, for example, real estate downtown Paris and what have you and stuff like that. But not the ordinary folk.
Mwalimu, there is a study I did once. It's very interesting. There is a very strong statistical relationship between longevity in office and the amount of wealth that a president earns. We can go down the list, but that's the reason why they don't want to give up power, because with that power comes a whole lot of wealth, and with that power also come a lot of pomp and circumstances. So when
pomp and pageantry,
pageantry. Mm-hmm. So when somebody like with his good intention, Mo Ibrahim, we give them millions of dollars to give off power when the time comes as an incentive. That's what they spend one day in a casino. So you see.
Correct.
So the idea, while it's noble, while it's good, sort of does not meet with the realities of.
And with Mo Ibrahim, really.
But I have to support my sister Amira here. We don't want to just leave this place with the negative note. There are some positives going on. With every old-time professor in some universities, I'm going not yeah. going to name that, I have a pre-packaged questions that a student who is doing innovative research for Africa must meet these things, or else they're not going to get their PhD. There are universities, there are other centers. I mentioned Codestria, that is doing a good job, great job, in trying to transform our thinking.
But you have to deal with people like Teodoro Obiang of this world.
Definitely.
This
is reality.
They but we also
have to look
too
at,
much space.
Yes. We
you
also
know?
Have to look like the University of Cabo Verde.
Yeah,
that is internationalizing its programs to link with their African brothers in the diaspora and other parts of Africa to share knowledge dealing with some of the same thing of good governance, democracy, and government in Cabo Verde. And Cabo Verde, for better or worse, is doing a whole lot better for a small island state than many of our states in Africa, especially in the ECOWAS region. Now, be quiet. I just thought I'd say that, so that way we don't live here thinking that everything is doomed. There are a lot of good things going on.
There is a saying that all of life is really about passion, action, and reaction. Mm-hmm. And to ignore the passion, the action, the reaction of your time or generation is to risk having not really lived at all.
That is
to
true.
Occupy space. Mm-hmm. You have a situation like Theodore Obiang, who obviously all the facts show, demonstrate that he is not interested in the concept of democracy. Mm-hmm. But you have his colleague, the Ugandan president, Yoweri Museveni, mm-hmm. who actually gave Theodore Obiang his country's highest award mm-hmm. and characterized it as he gave it to him because Mr. Obiang has been promoting African democracy.
Mm-hmm. So I think we have to recognize that the Obiangs of this world, the Musevenis of this world as well, you could add many to that list, particularly in these oil-rich places where you have also these multinational corporations that have kept them in power. So there is a geopolitical context in which they have maintained their dominance.
Or a sort of conspiracy.
Yes, for so many decades. I think we've got to put that on the table squarely as well, and to say that, you know, change comes regardless. People pressure, again, social movements, trade unions forging different paths to say we're going to hold these rulers accountable, we're going to hold these multinational corporations accountable, and, you know, we quite frankly have to also say the foreign militaries that are protecting the multinationals are also going to be scrutinized and critiqued. And so it's a whole picture of the local elites, the multinational corporations, and the geostrategic allies that have been on the wrong side of history. And I think people throughout the continent are saying, we demand our rights, we demand our dignity. So all the issues
are I like that, because
charity across the street
begins at home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, Professor, you had been talking about the need for African intellectuals to step up to the plate. Where are the Osman Sembenis when we need them?
Mm. Well, what has happened in Africa is I cannot exempt myself, we intellectuals, is that many of us have become pracademics. That is, we now collect data for the West because they pay us money, and then we are content, and the West does the analysis. They analyze us how they want to see us. That's one of the problems. The second is that some of us, the older generation, don't want to yield to new thinking.
Unfortunately, again,
Time
is not our best
That's
ally.
Another show altogether.
And there is no democracy in Studio 47 because, like a soldier, if the producer says go, you have to go.
Yeah.
Just like a soldier is told to be dismissed, you salute and go.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, thanks to our guests, today's Wafa May, Elamin, Emira Woods, and Abdul Karim Bangula. And thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter. And remember to keep the African hopes alive.